How do you spell that?
Cheryl. I think it's S-H-E-R-Y-L or L-double-L. Heiner, H-E-I-N-E-R. And Cheryl, right now, until recently, she was at PacBio. Mm-hmm. She had left, applied, and gone to work at PacBio. And I heard, I'm not quite sure, I heard it mentioned that she just left PacBio to go somewhere else. So you may be able to track her through Pacific PacBio.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, very good.
And she was the one who was, who had brought to my attention, or to our attention, the difficulty of pursuing the path that had been explored in Leroy's laboratory in terms of doing the gels in capillary columns. Lee's idea was to develop a device that would have as many capillary columns as one could accommodate in the optics, which hadn't been designed or anything like that. And we found that we could not, it was not possible to pre-fill capillaries with gels, leave them on the shelf, and ship them to customers. They deteriorated. So she brought that to our attention after I think the machine would have probably come out a year or two earlier if we had not abandoned that particular flawed design from the beginning. But anyway, when she brought it to our attention, we made a stop to that development and went to the flat plate, electrophoretic plate, and design an instrument that was able to optically read the flat plate as opposed to one we had started to design to read the optical gels. I think Mike Hunkapilla remembers this incident well, or the decision process well, and Cheryl was involved in that, and she was a key to the development, I think. It'd be interesting to talk.
I'll try to talk to her. We did talk to, who was involved later, Paul Grossman.
Paul was not yet at Applied Bio.
Right. He was, it was much later he was doing.
My history with Paul Grossman goes back to when he was 11 years old.
And the Berkeley Marina.
Exactly.
Yes.
So, but I think his first summer job was at Applied Bio because of the Berkeley Marina, in part. And then later, he worked at Applied Bio, took a leave from Applied Bio to get his doctorate, got his doctorate, came back, and he was involved in the development of the next generation capillary electrophoresis.
Yes, he told us about that, but that's another step.
Later history.
Now,
the one thing that's important to note, which in my interaction with various people who come and ask me about my history and history of the company, is that Applied Biosystems did not start to develop a DNA sequencer. The first product was a protein sequencer, and had we not developed the protein sequencer and developed the valving mechanics of handling all of the reagents that were needed for protein sequencer, the DNA sequencer probably would not have been developed in that form. Obviously, somebody else might have been. It's one of the things, people say you're the first to develop it. Well, if I hadn't done it, someone else would have done it, so it's not, you can't take full credit for it. So.
Well. But it's important, the way things do, in fact, unfold.
So we started with developing a protein sequencer. And the irony of it all is that I was trained as a physicist. And when I first heard that people sequenced proteins, sequence protein, what do you mean? I had to go to the library to find out what it meant to sequence a protein. And a year later, or a year and a half later, we put out on the market a protein sequencer. So I just happened to be there when that whole thing happened. So, okay.
Well, can we start at the, make this a biography and start at the very beginning?
The very beginning I was working at Hewlett-Packard.
No, I mean the very beginning where you were born, I assume.
No, I don't want to get
You don't want to?
No, I'll tell you why. I mean, it's not, okay. It's not that I want to do it. It's that I'm just about to finish a book which retraces my path in the context of my encounter with the Silicon Valley. So,
okay.
So I don't want to...
Sure. No, that's fine.
Okay. So when do you plan on finishing your history?
Well, we've got the December 2013 for the first volume of History of Biotechnology, and we're looking at a five-year period from 1976,
well,
maybe a little
well,
bit to...
It may very well be that in 3 to 6 months... I might ask you to read the manuscript if you'd like. So
very happy to do that. Just, sure,
you might learn something from it as well as help me.
Yes.
Correct a few things.
Happy to do that. That'd be great. Yeah.
Well, anyway, let me start with the beginning of Applied Bio.
Okay. Well, can we start with just briefly? You got into Hewlett-Packard and what you were doing there, getting into...
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, I got my PhD in Berkeley.
Yeah.
And after getting my PhD in Berkeley, I went back to France where I had done my undergraduate work with the idea of never coming back to the United States. Not because I hated or anything, but just that I'd come here to study and I wanted to go back to France. Mm-hmm. So I went back to France on a postdoc. And after 2 years of working in France, I decided that one had a little bit more freedom to do what one wanted in the context of American industry or academia.
Is that right?
Oh, yes. When I went to France, I was very much interested in working, in applying the physics. My training in physics was in spectroscopy. My PhD in biophysical mm-hmm. spectroscopy, if mm-hmm. you will, at Berkeley. And my original training in France and then at Berkeley was basically in the hard sciences, in physical sciences. And I got interested in wanting to apply the physical tools that I had learned to the biological arena, mm-hmm. without knowing exactly what that meant, okay?
Well, and how did you develop that interest in biology? You trained in physics. How did you move in that direction? Was it,
well,
mentors or?
It's part, one of those things I'm still in the process of exploring, okay. trying to understand.
But sure.
I think a key element of it was when I was in high school and Watson and Crick came up with the double helix thing, Crick was a physicist, so I thought it interesting that a physicist was okay. And I had gone into physics simply because in the French educational system you go into the things where you have the best grades, so I had the best grade in physics, so I went into physics. And while I was doing my doctoral thesis in Berkeley, magnetic resonance was the spectroscopy that I used, and there were some people who were starting to use magnetic resonance to look at biological systems. And I thought that might be interesting until someday another physicist came to give a lecture in Berkeley Physics Department, and that was his name escapes me right now. My memory is beginning to fail me on some detail. I can fill in the names later. Mm-hmm. He was the inventor of, the discoverer of the properties of liquid crystals, De Gennes. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I thought, well, this is interesting. The guy's working on liquid crystals. I looked at liquid crystals, and they made a cholesterol molecules at the time, and is what he used. What does cholesterol do? Well, cholesterol is involved in the structure of cellular membranes, and is involved in cellular membranes, and thinking in my mind about whether one could study the structure of cellular membranes by magnetic resonance. Anyway.
And nobody had done that.
I wouldn't make that statement. Oh. I don't know.
But you didn't know then either.
I didn't know then either, and I don't know now if people had done it then, because I have never been the kind of person who goes in the library and studies things to depth. I've always, in the context of applied biosystems and later, I've learned that there were people who can do that much better than I can. I'd better ask them to do it for me, or ask them to what they have learned on various topics. It takes me 15 minutes to get the results of hours of research, so I'm intrinsically lazy. So, anyway. So anyway, when I got my postdoc to postdoc in France, it was in the laboratory of someone who headed a National Research Council laboratory in France, who had come to visit with Professor Melvin Klein. Melvin Klein was the head of the lab at the time, but it was the lab of the guy who got the Nobel Prize for the
was it in Klein's lab or in Klein's department?
No. Melvin Klein was a senior scientist who ran the lab for
We can look it up.
You see those bumps here in my head? Well, I had a cerebral accident about 10 years ago, and chunks of my memory or my ability to remember have disappeared in that context. So I'm having have difficulty. Who was the discoverer of photosynthesis? Got the Nobel Prize for photosynthesis. Calvin something. He was at Berkeley, there's a round building behind the chemistry department at Berkeley that was built for him for his work.
Was it Pimentel?
No, not Pimentel.
That's the round building.
No. Pimentel started running the round building after what's his name died. what's his name?
We've got the clues. We'll figure it out.
But anyway, he came to visit that laboratory, and had nothing to do with that laboratory at the time, and he did not speak English, so they wanted an interpreter who knew the field, or who could at least translate some of the spectroscopy aspect. Mm-hmm. And so they came to me and said, well, Professor so-and-so is visiting the laboratory of so-and-so. Would you come and talk to him? I went and talked to him, and he was interested in the work I was doing. And the work I was doing at the time was something to do with magnetic resonance, and tying a magnetic resonance machine to one of the first mini computers that come out, the PDP-8 of Digital Equipment Corporation. And he came to my lab to meet me, we chatted for a while, I walked with him to where he wanted to visit, interpreted for him, he came back to my lab. And he said, well, how would you like to come and do that in France? I said, what? And he said, well, I would like very much for this technology to be in my laboratory in France, tying a computer to a magnetic resonance machine. And I said, yeah, sure, I'd like to. So a few weeks later, I got a check in the mail for the amount I had told him it would cost to put in to buy machines there, and he sent me a check for, I can't remember now, it was something of the order of $70,000 to $100,000, I don't remember exactly. A lot of money at the time, asking me to buy whatever was needed and ship it to France. And the check was signed by his name. In France then, and probably still now, the heads of laboratory have the signature on the money that's allocated to the laboratory. They have an apartment in the top floor of the laboratory. I mean, the whole thing is theirs. Okay. And so I went to do a postdoc there. And when I went to do a postdoc there, and we published papers on tying a computer to a magnetic resonance machine. As a matter of fact, the paper we published was probably the second paper ever to be published on a particular way to do, it was a Fourier transformed NMR. I think our paper came out a few months after a group at on the east coast of, you know, either Harvard or MIT had published something similar. Mm-hmm. And then because of that interest that had been germinating in my mind about looking at biological membranes, I wanted to do that after having, and they looked at me, but Monsieur, you are a physicist. Stick to physics. That's France. Mm-hmm. So after a while, I decided, well, probably I'm better off going back to California. Mm-hmm. And that was the end of towards the end of the Vietnam War. It was in 68, 69. Mm-hmm. And the guy who had hired me, who was happy with the work I'd done in France, told me, but you know, you're going to go back to America right now. People are being laid off. End of the Vietnam War. Economy's down. I told him, look, right now I feel like I'm better off living on food stamps in California than being tenured in Paris.
So having that was important to you, to have that freedom to do what you wanted to do.
I don't make it sound any more pompous than it really is. It depends how you say it. I came back. I wanted to come back. Yeah. I didn't like the idea of being constrained and confined. Mm-hmm. And I'm having, right now I have three companies in Europe that I either co-founded or I'm chairman of the board of the three companies. And I'm encountering the same kind of boxing of things. Mm-hmm. Things have changed, but not as much as all that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, we need to
pay things attention. Things are within a hierarchy.
So far, the story we've been telling is pretty U.S.-centric, but we need to globalize it. And so there's cultural kinds of elements.
That could be another chapter, element there. I'd be happy to talk to you about it.
I want to ask, working with magnetic resonance and trying to computerize this
trying to tie a magnetic resonance machine to a computer and look at mm-hmm. yeah.
So you were paying attention to developments in computing at that time, pretty new.
I wasn't really delving that deeply into it. Mm-hmm. I was making use of what people had done. Look, I've never invented anything in my life, okay? Although I've been involved with a lot of development. It's mm-hmm. just that whatever involvement I have had or contribution I have made was to see something over here that somebody knows and something over here that somebody else knows and see that if the two take them together, something else might come out.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good description of invention.
Well,
yes, no, I understand.
Okay, so,
sure.
It's, you know.
Mm-hmm. So you came back?
So I came back. And I came back and to give you the contrast between America and France at the time, I came back and my 2 years in France were well remunerated. I had enough savings to exist for a year if needed. Mm-hmm. And I started to say, okay, what am I going to do? I really would like to look at this. So I started making the rounds of big names or publications at UCSF, at Berkeley, and all that. I made some connections. Mm-hmm. And I ran into someone in UCSF who was interested in a particular class of cells, and I pointed out to him that now before pointing it out to him, I looked some papers and stuff that had been published, and those cells were interested because the cell walls had embedded in it a protein that regulated the transport of things from outside the cell to inside the cell, the release of calcium. And I went to him and said, look, I think some techniques of paramagnetic resonance, not nuclear magnetic resonance, but paramagnetic resonance could be useful in studying that particular mechanism in the cells. Are you interested? I talked to him for about an hour or so. He was in the School of Medicine. He listened to me and said, I have no idea what you're talking about. But if you can interest a granting agency of funding this work, I'd be happy to welcome you in my laboratory. And until then, you can use this desk, you can use my letterhead, you can use the key to the library. And if you want to submit an application for a grant, I'll support it. So I did. And a few months later, I got a grant from the National Institute of General Medical Sciences to do some paramagnetic work, paramagnetic resonance work. And at the same time, I found someone at Berkeley in the Department of Genetics who was interested in the same cell system and who was culturing these cells, mm-hmm. and I interested him and also.
What were the names at UCSF?
They're long gone, I mean.
Yeah.
It was the laboratory of Manuel Morales.
Manuel Morales, and at Berkeley?
At Berkeley. I'll have to, mm-hmm. I can't remember
okay,
right
yeah.
now.
And when you came back to the U.S., you knew you were coming here to the Bay Area.
Yeah, I came back to Berkeley because I knew Berkeley. I mean, I'd spent 7 years doing a PhD there. So.
And you thought that this place, there's as much science that you would find people that might be receptive to your ideas here as well as anywhere?
No. This was the area that I knew. And there was no point in me going to MIT or Harvard, or
yeah.
I knew nobody there. So
yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. And so I got the grant through the laboratory, the Manuel's laboratory, and I was made a fellow of the Cardiovascular Research Institute. Mm-hmm. So if you went to look at the Cardiovascular Research Institute, you'll find my name there. I had nothing to do with the cardiovascular work, but Manuel Morales was working on things having to do with heart-muscle contractility. And anyway, so I think he got me that just to...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it didn't cost him anything, and maybe you come up with something. Yeah,
it didn't cost him. So I was there for 2 years, and after that it was when I began to see the limits of the work that I was doing. Well, I wasn't an MD, there was no point, no possibility of me getting a full-time job, anyway, one day...
I'm just curious, did you live anywhere near, this is Parnassus
Heights? I lived in Berkeley.
Oh, you're in Berkeley, yeah, okay.
I lived in Berkeley, and I worked at the two places. I worked at the... at UCSF, in the lab at UCSF, and in the lab at the there was a collaborator of Morales was working in the University of the Pacific School of Dentistry. And so I spent some time in that guy's lab also, commuting between the two. They were working together, and for me, it was not a satisfactory arrangement. I was basically a glorified technician, if you will. You know the culture of the medical school, okay? So when came an opportunity for me to go work at Hewlett-Packard, because they were I had. In my work, used a lot of Hewlett-Packard equipment, and I've used the computer that I bought for the French laboratory. It was one of the first Hewlett-Packard mini computer. And so I said, I'll try to work at Hewlett-Packard. So I sent him a letter one day and got back a nice letter back saying, we're really very... credentials are impressive, and so I said, but we don't have any room for any one of those credentials right now. So I said, this is ridiculous. So I sat down and sent a letter to Bill Hewlett, and I'm telling him that I received this letter from his personnel department, and I just thought they really hadn't looked at the resume. So 2 or 3 days later, I got a communication. I can't remember if it's a letter or a phone call. Communication from his secretary saying that the head of the medical division of Hewlett-Packard in Boston is going to be here next week. He would like to meet you. Or Mr. Hewlett would like you to meet him, or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was a big event, and sending that letter, big decision, yeah.
Yeah. And so I met with, I went, and I met with, it turned out was Dean Morton, who eventually, many years later, succeeded to Hewlett, to Mr. Hewlett at the head of the company. So I met with Dean, and Dean Morton, who headed the medical division of Hewlett-Packard, who was on the East Coast. And not many people today remember that Hewlett-Packard was one of the leading supplier of medical equipment at the time.
What kinds of things were they developing?
Well, the give you a couple of examples. The best stethoscope on the market at the time was a Hewlett-Packard stethoscope. Any doctor that I saw, if he didn't have a Hewlett-Packard stethoscope, meant his judgment of quality was not good enough. Anyway, so it was a snob appeal at the same time. Fine. Other things of equipment of at Hewlett-Packard were electrocardiograms. If you go in a hospital today, they have an electrocardiogram taken. If it's over 20 years old, it will be a Hewlett-Packard one. If it's not over 20 years old, it will be a Philips one, because Philips acquired the medical division of Hewlett-Packard some years back. Okay, so they were doing a lot of monitoring of electrocardiogram, and they wanted to get into monitoring of other things. And what the important range for me was to see the head of a laboratory at the corporate labs of Hewlett-Packard, because he didn't think that my going to Boston would... In Boston, what they did is design the finished instrument that were developed at the corporate labs in Palo Alto. So he introduced me to the head of one of the labs in Palo Alto, and at that time he had been entrusted, that lab had been entrusted by Bill Hewlett to develop a non-invasive blood monitor for pH, PO2, and PCO2. And they were in the process of developing an ear oximeter. It was a device that today when you go to the hospital, they put something on your finger. Yeah. And that something on your finger looks at the oxygenation of your blood and measures the pulse rate at the same time. Well, that's the simpler heir to the first device that was developed on the ear to look at the color of the blood without having to take blood out. But the difficulty at the time was that look at the color of the blood without taking the blood out was interfered with by the color of the skin. You wanted to be able to take a black person's skin or a Chinese person's skin. Or no. And so they had figured that the ear being so well perfused with blood, there's usually much more blood in your ear than there is in your fingertips and so on and so forth, a device that looked through the skin at the ear, and they developed some software or some analytical software. It wasn't a computerized analytical software to look at the color of the blood and subtract the color of the skin. You know, look at it. It was very complicated, but for many years it was a very successful instrument. Until somebody else had the bright idea of saying, okay, if I want to look at the color of the blood, if I can synchronize that with the pulse, then any variation in the colored spectrum that varies with the pulse could not be the skin, because the skin color does not change with your pulse. What changes is the color of the blood. So that's why now you have a very cheap finger instrument. At the time, it was, you know, this was in 73, okay, so.
Yeah, was that HP who did the finger or somebody else?
That came later. I think that finger thing came after I left HP, so I don't know whether it came from HP or anywhere else. And I was peripherally involved in that ear thing, but in that department I started working on measuring PO2, oxygen pressure, carbon dioxide pressure, and pH, acidity of the blood.
This is some distance away from looking at cell membranes.
Totally. I mean, it's back to spectroscopy. Okay. So, working on cell membrane, I was sort of on the periphery of what was interesting, simply because I was used as a technician by people who are interested in the medical applications of stuff, but I couldn't be close enough. So I decided to go back to what I was really good at, which was spectroscopy. And that's why I wrote the letter to you.
Okay.
And so I worked on that, developed several instruments, and eventually became head of a section at Hewlett-Packard that was called Analytical and Medical Instruments and the Research Laboratory. It was a small group. I mean, I'm not glorifying it. You know, I never had more than 20 people. Okay. And we developed a number of things. And part of that development took me back to the medical profession, if you will, by getting to test some of those instruments in the surgical room during a cardiac operation on patients who had been opened up and whose blood needed to be monitored for oxygen or for PO2 or PCO2. So I worked at that for a little while. So I was at Hewlett-Packard. And one day, because at Hewlett-Packard, I was one of the few people there who, even though they were trained in the physical sciences, like most of the Hewlett-Packard people at the time, I had also dabbled in wet stuff. So whenever something came and was sent to any of the department of Hewlett-Packard that involved wet stuff, it was sent to me to evaluate. So because of this, that's why I'm telling you all of this. One day came in front of me a proposal for that some laboratory at Caltech, run by somebody called Leroy something or another, was offering a license to a modification that they had invented of a protein sequencer made by Beckman. I said, oh, one sequences protein, what does that mean? I went to the library, looked at it. No more than an hour. I never spent more than an hour in the library. But I found a couple of papers that indicated what was involved in doing this. I thought that might be interesting. Because at the time, in the group in which I was working, they were also working on a spectrophotometer. And so, as a matter of fact, at the time, it was one of the first spectrophotometers. It was the diode array spectrophotometer, the solid-state spectrophotometer. And I said, well, with that protein sequencer needs a spectrophotometer of some type to analyze the result of the biochemical reactions. Protein sequencer removes the amino acids one at a time, and when you remove an amino acid from the chain, you want to identify it, so you identify it by spectrometry. So I went to my boss. I said, that looks interesting. He said, that's too wet for us. That's too far from what we want to do. So I went over his head to the vice president of research, who was also a physicist. And I told him that, and I said, no, that's too wet for us. So I said, I returned the letter that came to my desk, saying that we might not be interested in that. And then I mentioned that to a colleague or a friend, I can't remember who to whom. And he said, that looks interesting. And, I said, no, I think I'm just going to say we're not interested in it. And then, out of the blue, came I was called by a venture capitalist. And
is this Bill Bowes?
No.
No? Somebody else?
Somebody else.
Something different?
And I was called by a venture capitalist who didn't reach me on the phone. He reached my secretary and left me a message. And I thought it was a headhunter. Because at Hewlett-Packard, if you're head of a laboratory, at the time anyway, if you're head of a laboratory, headhunters would call you and say, well, somebody else is looking for a VP of research, or looking, a small company is looking for this or that. And I always turned these away. Working at Hewlett-Packard was the greatest place I've ever worked at until Applied Biosystems. And I was not interested, so I...
Could you say a little bit more about working at Hewlett-Packard? What did you really enjoy about it?
I think it was the fact that it was not run by managers. It was run by Hewlett and Packard and by people whom they selected, who, based on their competence in what they did, were the ones who managed. They were not MBAs. Okay. I remember my first day at Hewlett Packard. I was shown around in the laboratory where I was going to be joining, and came in front of a table. There was a table, and the table had two electronic calculators. That was in 73. The two big electronic calculators, tabletop calculators. And these were the only ones in the laboratory. And if you wanted to do calculations, you went and sat at the table, you did it. And what you, if somebody wanted to do, they came and stood behind you and waited until you finished your calculation to go and do it. And one day, I went and I stood behind this thing, and I was stood behind the guy. I was number two in the line. And then an old man came to stand behind me, and I didn't know who he was, because even though I had written him a letter, I'd never met him. He had sent me to Dean Morton. The person in front of me said, "You know, is that behind you?" And I said, "No, he said, it's Bill." And I said, well, so I turned around and I said, "Oh, please, you can help me." No, that's all right. What I do is not important, just that my calculator has broken down. I'll wait. That's the kind of person he was. I mean, it was obvious in the meetings when he reviewed a project, etc., that he really knew what he wanted, what he didn't want. He asserted himself, but always in a manner that didn't make you feel small in any way. I mean, you knew that he was also, he obviously and evidently and all that, was better than you at what he did, but it didn't strike you in any way as being, it was so obvious that it didn't bother you. Mm-hmm. He didn't, because he didn't use it for anything. And so was Packard also, project reviews and so on. The atmosphere at Hewlett-Packard was one in which, you know, you were trusted to do your job. If you came in early, came in late, it didn't matter. You could come and go. You could. And another thing too, at a project review once, I remember it was 2 or 3 years into the company, I was very proud that the small group that I was managing had successfully met a number of milestones on the 3 or 4 projects that we were working on. And David Packard walked back, looked at these things, and he said, "Well, there's only one thing wrong here," he said. I said, "What's that?" He said, "Well, you don't have a project that has failed, which means that you're not pushing hard enough towards new stuff."
That's interesting, yeah.
Okay. They don't always take the safe approach.
Mm-hmm. There's not too many places that would encourage you to fail. Yeah.
Well, it wasn't encouraging you to fail. It was encouraging to really reach out.
Right.
Reach out and don't be afraid. Mm-hmm. Don't be afraid to fail. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, that's.
Yeah,
no. I mean, I could talk for hours on that.
Did you have a sense being at Hewlett-Packard and being in Silicon Valley that, you know, there's really something going on here, that the future is being invented here? Did you have that sense that, you know, this is a special place? That this is the place to be, if, you know?
No.
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
And in spite of the meeting the other night that brought together in that room all of the creators of the whole thing, I still don't think that it is. I don't think it is as special a place as people want to make it out. There's no question that it has a lot to offer, but let me qualify this. I think for the junior scientist that I was at the time, what mattered more is to find a place where you had the possibility of enjoying your work, rather than feeling you're going to transform the world.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, it's much easier for me today to say, well, maybe I have contributed something to the biotechnology arena and so on and so forth, but I have never wanted to get to the point of doing that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sure. No, but I understand. Yeah.
I don't know if I'm explaining myself.
Yeah, no, perfectly. Yeah, no, I understand it. So it is very much about doing this task and then the next one and making progress. And
enjoying it.
Yes.
And enjoying working with the people you're working with and so on. Mm-hmm. So anyway, where were we?
You'd been contacted by a venture capitalist.
Yes, I contacted by the, well, I didn't know he was a venture capitalist. I thought he was a headhunter. Mm-hmm. And so it got to the point where my colleagues in the lab, my secretary, started begging me to please talk to him because he kept calling and calling, trying to reach me, leave message with anybody to reach me and all that. So please meet him, get rid of him so he doesn't call anymore. So I met him. And and I found out that the reason he wanted to talk to me was because he wanted to start a diagnostic company developing new diagnostic instruments that would leverage off of the genetic engineering revolution that was beginning to happen. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so what has that got to do with me? That was the time when the Bayer-Cohen thing had been advertised, when Genentech was being created, and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And he was saying, well, this gene splicing is going to create a lot of opportunities for new diagnostics, and me and my partners want to be able to create a diagnostic company to take advantage of it. I said, fine, but I've never invented anything in diagnostics. I don't know anything about diagnostics. And I really don't have the time to go to the library to learn about diagnostics just for you. He said, no, that's all right. I think you have the stuff in you. I said, what do you know about me? And he said, well, it turned out that someone had sent to Hewlett-Packard a proposal for a diagnostic process that had come through my desk, as wet things usually did. And I had looked at it and had decided that it didn't really make any sense, it wasn't going to work. And it had come to me through its inventor. So I agreed to see the inventor, met with him, he described to me what he wanted to do, and I decided what he wanted to do really didn't make any sense. And so I told him so, and I told him I'm not interested. So he went back to his venture capitalist to whom he had tried to complain about this guy at Hewlett-Packard who had thought that his invention wasn't really worth anything. In the meanwhile, that venture capitalist and his colleagues had paid a large sum of money to a professor I won't name at Berkeley to look at the same thing, and he had gotten back to them after, he said, weeks of study to tell them that the idea won't work for the same reason I'd given in 5 minutes to the other guy. Mm-hmm. So venture capitalist felt that I was worth at least as much as the professor who had cheated him out of a sizable fee. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so this was the only reason he wanted me, and I told him no, but no thanks. I wasn't interested. And he kept after me, and one day then there was another venture capitalist.
Well, who was this? Can you?
I'd better not.
Okay.
I'd better not mention him.
Okay.
And and then another venture capitalist whom I'd met and known socially, and who had kept trying to interest me in doing a company with him. And his way of interesting me in doing a company with him was whenever I met him, he'd reach into a jacket pocket and pull out a check for $75,000, $150,000, $200,000, saying he had just gotten this from participating in a company. And said, look, it's much easier. What are you working for? At the time, a head of department at Hewlett-Packard Laboratory made $75,000 a year, and this guy would pull out checks of twice that amount and ask every week and telling me, what the hell are you working for?
No.
That's the kind of thing you do. I kept telling him, well, look, I haven't invented anything. I can't, I don't know. He wanted me to start a company with him.
Mm-hmm. Can't name him either?
Huh?
Can you name him?
Wait a second.
Okay.
And let me decide. Mm-hmm. And well, I'll name him if you won't make a caricature out of him, as I just did.
Okay.
About the checks out of
his pocket. Sure, sure, sure.
And we became.
That was a joke. He's doing.
It wasn't a joke. He really was proud of the fact that he was trying to prove to me that working for a salary didn't make any sense. Mm. That if one had something up there, one should. And could, if one could and should, use it to better effect, and it wasn't necessarily for the check.
Okay. Yeah, but this does say something about the environment at the time.
It does. It does. But to me, it was not a positive thing. Okay. It was not a positive thing because I've always felt, and I still feel, that to do something just for money doesn't appeal.
Well, yeah, but this is the idea that, well, you can do a lot with, you're doing something here, okay, for Hewlett Packard, but you know, you can do, there are lots of other things to do, and we can help you do it, right? That's,
okay, well, yeah. Anyway, that by in itself was never a motivator for me.
So, sure.
Okay, let's leave it at that. And so, when the first venture capitalist whom I tried to shake off came back to me with another idea, that other idea that he had was to get me involved with this Leroy something or another down at Caltech, who was in the process of getting involved in a company called Amgen, and they wanted to develop a protein sequencer. And that was the protein sequencer that I was in the process of turning down mm-hmm. from the perspective of Hewlett Packard. And so that guy came back with that idea. I mentioned it to the other guy who wanted me to start a company with him. And he, of course, was one of the guys who were interested in MJN also. And he knew about the thing. And that's how I got involved with the idea of maybe getting involved with the protein sequencer. Mm-hmm. And after having a conversation with my boss at Hewlett Packard and telling him that is there a problem if I've already turned this down that was offered to us and you told me it was not for us and so did your boss, and would it be okay if I went and tried to do something with it? So, mm-hmm.
And that you would leave?
I would leave Hewlett Packard.
Yeah.
So I decided to leave Hewlett Packard, and it was in 79. Mm-hmm. And I, through the second individual, who is Moshe Alafi, I met Bill Bowes. Mm-hmm. And Bill flew down to Caltech with me to meet Leroy Hood. And in the meanwhile, I managed to spend a couple of hours in the library to learn about the Beckman protein sequencer that Leroy Hood says he had modified. Mm-hmm. And anyway, that started the process. Mm-hmm. And
you looked at the sequence and you thought, okay, this could work?
It took me a while.
Yeah.
It took me a while. And here this. There's one thing I really need to say, and I want. I think more than anything of all of the things that I read or studied or looked at or people I talked to during this period when I was trying to make up my mind whether to leave Hewlett Packard and get involved in this, the one element that really guided me towards doing it was the persistence with which Bill Bowes made himself available and the amount of time he spent with me to reassure me, to prod me, to push me. Okay, maybe in retrospect I'm exaggerating it a little, but it stands out in my mind as the important catalyst. Mm-hmm. Okay, and this is a little chapter I want to open here, because I think I alluded to that in the letter I sent here after I was invited to the meeting the other night. And really, the main reason why I made it a point, since I'm living abroad now, to be here during this period, was to come to the evening, because I wanted an opportunity to basically tell Bill Bowes what I just told you. The venture capitalists that I ran into in the context of Applied Biosystems were Pitch Johnson, Bill Bowes, Moshe Alafi, and the assistant to Pitch Johnson at the time was Craig Taylor, now at Alloy. And so Craig came in a little later in the process, but he was also of the same caliber, if you will, very human caliber, rather than a business school machine. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I found my work in the context of these venture capitalists who operated primarily on the basis of their emotional assessment of an individual rather than, there were several others who became investors in Applied Biosystems in that one round of finance. Applied Biosystems did only, well, there was some seed money, but initially, but there was only one major round of financing. Now, all the people who came in, they basically came in after a 15 minutes meeting with me, on which they decided, the horses look, teeth look good. I'm betting, okay. Yeah. It was not, they may have had a whole bunch of credit agencies going after my past and something like that, I don't know. But the fact is that my feeling is that guys like Moshe, guys like Bill, guys like Tom Perkins, no, I'm sorry, not Tom Perkins. Tom had never got involved with Gene Kleiner. They were people who, they met you, they assessed you, and they decided, based on that, that they would bet on you. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, that they would also trust your judgment and not interfere with it unless it looked crazy. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you had the same sense that this is sort of the basis for
doing business. Well, I think the sense that I had was that I knew nothing about what putting a company together was going to be, okay? And I needed a lot of information on that. I needed to learn about the process, and these people were willing and able to spend the time to answer a lot of questions which today I would consider stupid, okay? But Bill would pick me up in his car. He had a convertible two-seater Mercedes at the time that he said he loved this car. It was a gift from his wife. Anyway, it's a red two-door, 220 SL or something like that, those days. And he'd come and pick me up. We'd go and and visit would fly down to Caltech to meet Lee Hood or to meet the chancellor's office at Caltech in the process of negotiating a license and trying to get a license. And whenever I had questions about anything, I'd just call him and ask him, you know. And so he was, whether it was he or Pitch or Moshe, I mean, I got in the habit of having breakfast with Moshe at least once a week at his house.
He was also in Berkeley.
Yeah, I lived in Berkeley too. And so it was, I learned a lot from them without ever feeling that I was being tutored, okay? I would like in some way to acknowledge that debt, okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly.
Yeah. And the other one is that if you talk to some of the early employees of Applied Biosystems, you'll probably get similar reactions from them in the context of how I tried to treat them and how I tried to run with them, which is a behavior I basically copied from Bill Hewlett. Okay. And so, as a matter of fact, I remember writing a letter to Bill Hewlett. I think it was 2 years or 3 years into Applied Bio, thanking him for what I had learned from Hewlett Packard that enabled me to rapidly get. We had a startup in which a lot of people were hired who had never had any industrial experience. There was only one person who had industrial experience and who, without whom I couldn't have made Applied Bio, that was Andre Marion, whom I met at Hewlett Packard. And to have gathered a group of people, some of whom were fresh out of school and who had never had any industrial experience, and with Andre's help, created an atmosphere that was able to ship a first revolutionary instrument, that protein sequencer, less a year and a quarter after we started.
Yeah.
It fell off the truck after World War II.
Right.
But anyway, but it didn't break.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, but that's, you know, at any time of the day or night, you went to Applied Biosystems, there was one or two cars, there were people working, there was just this enthusiasm at creating something. Mm-hmm.
And at Hewlett-Packard, you're making this, going through the process of, you know, looking at this opportunity and thinking, okay, do I jump and do I get involved with this? You were involved in negotiating the license from Caltech. Was that before you left, or was it?
I wasn't negotiating a license with Caltech before I left. Before I left Hewlett-Packard, I only had interactions with Moshe, Alafi, and Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And trying to understand what was involved and so on. And then when I decided to leave, you look back at it, and I told when I was going to leave and all that, and created the house in order, left my house in order over there.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I started to negotiate. So my arrangement with the five venture capitalists who were at the origin of Applied Biosystems was, I'll leave my job, I'll work for free, that would be my contribution, and each of the five wrote a check for $50,000. So at $250,000, and me, and we created the company 50-50 for me and 50-50 for the five of them.
Mm-hmm.
That was before we would go to their venture firms to get the next money.
Uh-huh. Okay. That was a pretty good deal for you. I mean, that's...
Well, when everything was all was set down and the company was running, I ended up with 5 or 6% of the company. So,
mm-hmm.
In the end, it was basically what a fair amount of this for a CEO was that. Mm-hmm. So, okay. Mm-hmm. So, no, I'm not complaining. I mean, they didn't try to cheat me in any way or anything like that. But, so that's how. But then what happened was, I wanted to get started. And so what happened was, I had $250,000 from these guys, mm-hmm. and I managed to raise another $250,000. And the other $250,000 were $50,000 deposits from five institutions for the first five protein sequencers to be built by a company not yet incorporated, for a technology not yet licensed, and with a promise that it would be delivered without a promise of performance, because I couldn't promise a performance since I didn't know enough about it. Okay?
So how did you do that? That's pretty good.
I did it. Yeah. And I got five checks for $50,000. One came from Amgen, which was just being financed, mm-hmm. and Amgen had Leroy Hood on its
on the board
and all that,
advisory board.
So they were happy to give $50,000 check.
Was there any thought at Amgen of developing? They'd been talking to him about perhaps developing this instrument there.
Well, they had talked at one point about developing that instrument for their own use, and in fact, the first interactions with me was whether I would fit in the context of Amgen or not. Okay. And I went to visit Amgen with Bill Bowes and then told him that either you create an instrument or you're going to sell broadly or I don't want to be involved. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so when they decided to do a standalone company, Amgen put the money in. Mm-hmm. So there was Amgen, Monsanto, what's a big institute down in La Jolla?
Scripps?
Salk.
Salk.
Mm-hmm. The Salk Institute. I think CentoCore. Mm-hmm. And can't remember who the fifth was. Mm. Anyway, we got $250,000 from these, $250,000 from the five VCs. So that was $500,000. In today's money, it's about $4 to $5 million, okay? Mm-hmm. That was enough to start the company. So it's only when I got this money in that the few people that I wanted to join me in Applied Biosystems left their jobs to join me.
And one was Andre Marion?
One was Andre Marion.
What kind of... Tell me about how you knew him at Hewlett-Packard. And
well, like me, he had grown up in France. So it was natural for us to meet in the context of Hewlett-Packard because we were in the same corporate laboratories. First thing when I said, oh, you were educated in France. Did you meet Andre Marion? No, I didn't. Oh, I met Andre Marion. And actually... The way I got Andre Marion interested in this project was, it was just before I left Hewlett-Packard, I started looking for people I needed, someone who knew electronics, and so I first started recruiting people from the electronic shop that supported my department at the University of California, where I had built much of the electronics for interfacing computer to my magnetic resonance machine a few years earlier. Mm-hmm. I talked to them, but they were part of the Berkeley culture. They didn't really want to work very hard. It wasn't mm-hmm. okay. I interviewed a few other people in my milieu in Berkeley and didn't feel that they were really going to fit. I had already been 7 or 8 years at Hewlett-Packard, so I was already biased.
Industrialized. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And so it was on the day when I decided to leave Hewlett-Packard. I went to the credit union to clear out my account and take things from a savings account I had there. So I cleared it. On the way out of there, Andre Marion walked in to do something with his credit union account. And he said, oh, how are you doing? What's happening? I told him, well, I'm just cleaning up my account. Why are you cleaning up your account? I said, well, I'm leaving. I'm going to start a company. And he said, oh, that's very interesting. What's it about? I told him, well, if you have time, I'll come by your office and let you know. I've got to run right now. So I walked out because another interview had been lined up. So I walked out and I looked at myself, told myself, look, goddammit, I'm looking for a guy that is exactly on his qualifications. So I walked around. Andre, the company is to build instruments of a particular nature. I'll tell you about it later. But would you be interested? And he said, yeah, why not? I'm bored where I am. So I told him, okay,
What was he doing at Hewlett-Packard?
Remember the first calculator watch that Hewlett-Packard made?
I don't remember it. I remember them.
Yeah, but they made a calculator watch that didn't make it because it was... you had to press a button, LED would light up. It was the first of the generation of electronic watches before the Japanese started flooding. And so he developed that at Hewlett-Packard. He still has one that he carries with him. I had one that was stolen from him. And before that, he had worked with another electronic company. I think he had worked with Marchand, the electric calculator company, before he went to Hewlett-Packard. Mm-hmm. I didn't know him very well. I mean, we hadn't socialized much. We just would run into each other in the cafeteria and talk about our immigrants' adventures or misadventures. And that's about the extent of our relationship. But I knew about his work, and he had a good reputation in the company and so on. So. Mm-hmm. So that's why I asked him to join me, and he did. And we spent a lot of time while he was working, spent a lot of evening at his house, putting together a plan on what would be needed and learning. The first proposal from Lee Hood was that we would build a kit that would upgrade the Beckman sequencers. That was his idea of what a company should do.
So you would have a built-in customer base with anybody who had a Beckman sequencer?
Yeah, I know, but I said that's not... You don't want to be an accessory to Beckman. Mm-hmm. Either you do it right or you don't. Yeah. So that's what we decided. What I decided to do is that if we're going to start Applied Biosystems, we're going to make a full sequencer. We're not going to build kits for Beckman. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can you tell me about the first, you went down to Caltech with Bill Bowes and your first encounter with Lee Hood? And
yeah, it was an encounter with Lee Hood. But it was no different than the encounter with Lee Hood the other night. I mean, Lee Hood is Lee Hood. Yeah. I mean, he's always full of ideas in the future and what he's going to do. And he likes to talk a lot about what he's done, like to talk about a lot about what he's going to do. He hasn't changed.
Yeah.
And of course, he was... the interesting thing about the protein sequencer is that it was invented, and the protein sequencer, the difference between it and the Beckman was, the main contribution was that to sequence a protein, you have to do a particular, what's called Edman degradation, particular chemical reaction for every amino acid in the chain you want to analyze. Mm-hmm. The biochemistry removes an amino acid, allows you to analyze it, then goes back and removes the next end amino acid. Mm-hmm. It can only cleave the protein at the end amino acid. And so when you do that, you have different cycles. When you do a reaction, then you have to wash the result of that reaction, do more, and wash. But every time you wash away some of the original protein. So after a number of washes, there's no more protein left.
There's no more
protein left, and you can only go so many length, such a length. So someone had the bright idea, not Leroy Hood, had the bright idea of doing that chemistry in the gas phase. Mm-hmm. And by doing it in the gas phase, all of the reactions are done in vapor, the vapors don't wash anything, and only the last wash, to wash the results of the reaction, is only one wash instead of five or six washes per cycle. So you can go much farther down the line.
Who was that?
It was Lee Hood's PhD advisor.
Dreyer. Okay.
Dreyer had developed the gas phase sequencer, had formed a company to try to build it, and had failed. And Leroy had taken the basic idea of the vapor stuff and adapted it to his Beckman sequencer. Leroy is very imaginative, and he's also a little bit of that same streak of finding a good idea and taking it and putting there. Okay.
And the venture capitalists, Moshe Laffy and Bill Bowes, and they knew of this history with Dreyer?
Oh, sure. Of course. It was never hidden. It's just that Bill Dreyer is not the self-advertising person that Leroy is. And so the negotiation started with the board of trustees at Caltech and the licensing office at Caltech, a lot of discussions went on, and many of these discussions needed the support of the venture capitalists represented by Bill Bowes at the time, simply because from Bill's past there was a resume behind him, and so he lended credibility to the fact that the company was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And so he was involved in this, and I participated in some of them. Caltech had tried to sell. Now, this is something I'm not sure of. If I'm going to tell you right now, is totally accurate or not. You may want to verify that with Lee. Okay. Caltech had attempted to license, or at least I think, or was told they had attempted to license the technology to DuPont, to Beckman, and to someone else, but I don't know who. Mm-hmm. And critical to that handling of the chemistry and the vapors that were involved in that gas phase sequencer was a particular valve design that had been developed, not in Leroy's laboratory, had been developed at the Max Planck Institute, and that Leroy had basically had copied by a handmade process by a machinist in his laboratory, who was an exceptional machinist and was able to do this very complicated valving arrangement. And as I recall having heard, whether it was DuPont or Beckman or anybody else they had talked to, the machining of these valves and the manufacturing of these valves was deemed to take probably more time than might be worth for the development of an instrument. Mm-hmm. And part of the licensing may have been that they had promised not to be able to do anything until a year or two of development, because these things were difficult to manufacture and so on. So while these discussions were going, and while Bill was trying to ensure that we would get a hearing from the appropriate licensing people, I had one of my engineers at Hewlett-Packard, whom I had eyed as being a potential recruit for Applied Biosystems, look at the problem. And he had found another machinist who was an employee of Hewlett-Packard but who also had a machine shop in his house where he moonlighted over the weekend. And he had gotten this guy to make, to actually manufacture a valve relatively easily. So when I went to talk to the trustees and say, well, somebody said to the effect, I don't remember exactly, but somebody said something to the effect, well, what makes you think you can manufacture this, since we have already been told by, I don't remember whom they quoted, that this would take years to develop. I said, no, it won't take years to develop, here it is. And which was much to the chagrin of Leroy Hood's machinist, who thought he was going to be making the valves for us at a very expensive price. Mm-hmm. That we found a way for that guy to make them really inexpensively. Now, an interesting sidebar that illustrates the environment that we have here. Mm-hmm. This machinist who was moonlighting at Hewlett-Packard, when we formed Applied Biosystems and started manufacturing our machines, mm-hmm. we contracted with him to make those valves for us.
Right.
He created a small company that is now a much bigger company. And he still offers to do anything I would get him to do if I would just start another company, okay? But he employs 40 or 50 machinists in his shop. Mm-hmm. And so it's...
Yeah, where is he at?
Hmm?
Where is his company at?
His name is... I get my memories playing tricks on me. It's Joe Ilmberger.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
ILM Berger. And his machine shop is in the Silicon Valley here. I don't know if I have it here with me. Let me double check.
So we can find out.
Yeah, I'm taking some
notes here. No, I don't have the name of his company here.
Yeah, that's fine. You can look
him up.
Yeah. And well, I have a couple questions.
Yeah.
Did that cause any kind of friction with Lee Hood's lab, the fact that, you know...
I think to some extent it might have, because... it removed another excuse for saying collaboration.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And what about Hewlett-Packard taking people?
Well, I think that look, at the same time as I was forming Applied Bio and we got started, mm-hmm. and when we got started was with the 500,000.
Yes.
The 50 times 5 from mm-hmm. clients and VCs. That's when I got about 7 or 8 people, mm-hmm. of which all but 2 came out of Hewlett-Packard.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time as I was doing this, I had maintained a good relationship with Dean Morton, who had been my first introduction to the labs. And as a matter of fact, I had a long discussion with Dean about whether he would join the board of Applied Bio. And it was not called Applied Bio at the time, it was still Genetic Systems.
Mm-hmm.
But and then I got on the day before Hewlett-Packard announced their collaboration deal with Genentech called HP Genenchem. Remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
Or you've seen that one? Dean Morton told me, said, something will be announced tomorrow. I can't tell you what it is right now, but this will prevent me from being on your board, be a conflict.
Right.
So there was no hard feeling on the part of Hewlett-Packard. I think Hewlett-Packard prided itself. I mean, I wrote that letter to Bill Hewlett.
Mm-hmm.
He responded back, says, he was very happy that he may have contributed. So it's generous of me to think that he had contributed to my ability to do this, but over the years it was Hewlett-Packard had contributed to much of what happened in the Valley and will continue to do so. I mean, it was...
Yeah, it was very much the culture.
It was almost a normal thing to happen, but yeah, the thing is, it doesn't happen very often. It's very hard to draw people out of Hewlett-Packard. It was at the time. Mm-hmm. It was very hard to draw people out of Hewlett-Packard.
Because it was the leading...
You had a secure job there. I mean, when people asked me at the time when I was considering leaving, well, isn't it risky for you to leave? I said, what am I risking? I can always come back.
You had that sense that you Did you have conversations about that with anybody there?
No.
It was just understood.
It was understood. I mean, it was clear that if I failed, that actually the fact that you had gone to try something and failed put you higher up on the list of possibilities to become a manager than anybody who had not done anything.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
Which is very different from the Hewlett-Packard of today.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the two people of the original group that you brought in, mostly they came from Hewlett-Packard, but the others are these Berkeley people? Or
No, I think all except the two came from Hewlett-Packard.
Except
the original.
Yeah, the two, who are the two? Where did you find the other two?
I think André was the one who was in charge of looking for engineers. I mean, when we started the company, André was the chief engineer. I was the CEO, chairman of the board, and head of research.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I retained this head of research title for three years, until I convinced Mike Hunkerpiller to leave Caltech and join us. Mike joined us just on the eve of going public.
Yeah. And did you meet? He was in Lee Hood's lab when you originally went down there. Mike Hunkerpiller.
Mike Hunkerpiller and Lloyd Smith, who's at
Wisconsin
now. Yeah.
And so you met them and.
I met them and knew what they were doing. I had Mike spend a lot of time explaining to me the chemistry, and writing up things for me to look up and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all very. I never hid from them. My ignorance, and they were very helpful in trying to fill it where needed.
So. Yeah. Did you have some kind of formal arrangement with them for consulting, those guys in particular, or?
Lee had a consulting. I think Lloyd may have had a consulting arrangement. I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
I know Mike had a consulting arrangement for a while before he was pulled out of there. And I think that's about it.
Yeah. Was there ever any question of locating the company down there?
No.
No? And why not? Amgen was there, down that way.
Yeah, but I lived here.
Yeah, okay. So, no.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, the reason why Applied Biosystems was located in Hayward is because it was halfway between Berkeley and Palo Alto, where André lived.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And where... the bulk of the other Hewlett-Packard people I was going to hire lived closer to Palo Alto than they did to the North Bay. So I said, look, I'll commute halfway if you guys will commute halfway. And the other reason also was that we were the first company to locate in the Hayward area, in what is the big industrial park right now in Hayward. When we, as a matter of fact, just to be faithful to the mythology, we rented the garage in Foster City for the first 9 months of the company until such a time as the first building went up in the complex where the company is located now. And so I signed the lease for the, I think it was about the third of the space of the building that we were to occupy, with an option on the additional space. And over the 7 years that I ran the company, Applied Bio took over the whole building and five others in the complex.
Mm-hmm. And in Hayward, it was a conducive environment in terms of business. They were happy to have you.
I'll tell you something now. I don't know if it gets published, it's going to cause me to go to jail. Or not, the other reason why André and I located in Hayward is because the site where we were going to be was right next to the sewage treatment plant, which we used to smell every now and then. And we figured that if, perchance, our ability to control the emanations from the building of the toxic chemical, not toxic, of the very volatile chemicals that we were going to use at Applied Bio, people would think it's coming from the sewage treatment plant, that won't bother us. Okay, so.
Yeah.
Because we use ammonia and trifluoroacetic acid.
That's the gas.
Yeah, it's a liquid form, but the ammonia also evaporates, and stinky stuff.
Yeah. So, and is it a stinky machine, or was it a stinky machine originally?
Well, you had to evacuate it through a proper hood and all that.
Okay. Well, how did the work proceed? Was it smooth sailing, or were there difficulties trying to get this thing to work?
Look, I hired, if I remember correctly now, at the time of the protein sequencer, I remember specifically of two biochemists that I hired. Mm-hmm. And a third one who may have come a little later, I can't remember now. Mm-hmm. And the ones that I hired were always people who had been overlooked somewhere else. Okay? I tried to hire people who had a similar path as mine, where I tried to do something in a big way in some place, like I tried to do something with UCSF and I failed at it, or it didn't quite fit. Mm-hmm. But I knew that a lot of people may have that problem, although they have certain qualities that you could exploit also. And so I wouldn't tell them that today, because, you know, but in fact, if they hadn't, I knew they were eager to succeed or to do something that would be worthwhile, okay? Mm-hmm. One of them now, he failed again. His last effort was a failure. He was the chief scientist at Helicos in Boston.
Bill
Efkovich. Mm-hmm. And he was one of the first biochemists I hired. Not for protein sequencing. I hired for the next, what I thought at the time was going to be our next product, and which became our next product, the DNA synthesizer. Mm-hmm. Bill Efkovich had done his work in Denver with Carruthers.
Yes.
Carruthers. And Carruthers didn't really think very highly of Bill. That's why I hired Bill. And Bill is the one who had really gotten the chemistry to work in Carruthers' laboratory. And Carruthers was, to my mind anyway, did not recognize adequately Bill's, because Bill is a little bit of a self-effacing, subdued individual. He's not a self-promoter or anything. Mm-hmm. And anyway, so I hired Bill. Bill, unfortunately, he did a good job at Helicos, but I think from the start,
the technology
had flaws in it. I looked at it at the very beginning and didn't want to get associated with it. He's now heads a big group at Affymetrics. So, yeah. So he had good substance to him. So, Bill. The other one was, I think, Norm Whiteley. He was a protein chemist who joined it. I don't know what he does now. I think he retired after we went public. But he worked very hard at getting the protein sequencer to work. Mm-hmm. And there were one or two other biochemists that we hired, and then group of mechanical engineers and electrical engineers. They're the ones who really made the machines. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't have been able to do that unless Andre and I knew whom, what kind of people we wanted to recruit for this. They were generally young scientists, fresh out of college, or 1 or 2 year experience. That's it. Mm-hmm. And the two of them are now involved in another sequencing startup. Okay.
And this group, this is the Sol project? Yeah, how are we doing on time?
It's your time.
Well,
I have to be back in Berkeley. I have to be in Berkeley by 6:30, so.
Okay, how long does it take you to?
45 minutes on BART.
Okay. The protein sequencer is the Sol product that you're working on initially?
Well, we started with the protein sequencer, but immediately after that started with the DNA synthesizer. The DNA synthesizer, that's why Bill Efkovich joined us, mm-hmm. after I got a license from Boulder for the chemistry.
And was this something that at the beginning of the company, where Bill Bose and Moshe Laffy said, come build this protein sequencer and then we're going to do a DNA synthesizer?
Look, I'll have to find it in my files. I did not have time to look for it before our meeting today, but I fully intend to find it in my, I think it's in a document, in a PDF document on the computer I had before I bought this iPad, and I'll email it to you. It's the first handwritten one-page business plan of Applied Bio, on which it had the protein sequencer, DNA synthesizer, peptide synthesizer, and DNA sequencer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
That was the plan that I had made at the beginning, and it was only after the DNA sequencer was ready to ship that combination of some heart problems and other results of a very exciting but very stressful 7 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
During those 7 years, I didn't take a vacation, I didn't do anything except.
Yes,
but anyway, so I fulfilled those four things.
Yeah.
That was.
And do you remember the discussions putting that together? This is discussions with who? With Lee Hood and with.
Well, I have to. Nothing, as I said earlier, was originated with me. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that when we first started talking with Lee Hood was the protein sequencer, but I don't remember in what particular discussion or at which particular moment I must have asked the question, if we're a company to do protein sequencer, that's not going to be enough because you have to have other products. What are the other likely products? Well, I think from these discussions came the. Well, let me backtrack. When I started the discussion, the visits with Amgen and learning a little bit about Amgen and who was involved, I learned that Leroy Hood and Marv Carruthers were involved in a project collaboration between them to help sequence a particular protein at Amgen, and from the sequence of that protein find out what was the DNA sequence that coded for it so as to synthesize the DNA probe and fish out the gene.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the only way you could find out a DNA sequence in those days, even though the DNA sequencing biochemistry existed, but it was very difficult to use manually, you couldn't get enough bases and all that. If you knew the protein sequence, you could design a probe to fish out the gene, and after fishing out the gene, maybe you could sequence it. Mm-hmm. Okay. So they were working on that. So the notion of using the manual chemistry that had been developed in Marv's laboratory to synthesize DNA, the purpose was to use it to synthesize a DNA probe mm-hmm. for that, so that Amgen could know what gene to work on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Right.
So Lee and Marv had some kind of agreement, I don't know the details of it, to work together. And so from these discussions, it was natural that a next product would be a DNA synthesizer. Since you're sequencing the protein to be able to make a probe so you can fish out a gene, you would want to enter that protein sequence into a machine that would give you the probe. Mm-hmm. So why not automate that manual chemistry? Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, after we got the sequencing license for the protein sequencer from Caltech, we said, okay, we're going to be using the same valving that was developed for the protein sequencer, since we knew how to manufacture it in Joe Ilmberger's shop. We could know how, these valves could also be used in a DNA synthesizer. We wouldn't have to do much development for it. Mm-hmm. So let's plan on doing a DNA synthesizer and automating that chemistry. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to have a license to that chemistry from the university at Boulder. But the university at Boulder sort of was hesitant about giving us a license because we were a small company, we hadn't proven ourselves yet, protein sequencer hadn't come out, all that kind of stuff. Clearly, Leroy wanted us to have access to that chemistry as he worked with Marv, because he himself got a nice chunk of Applied Bio for one thing, the process of starting it. The economic interest always spices things a little. And so he was rooting for us to get that, both because he was interested for it to come out of the same thing that he had helped create. Mm-hmm. And he was working with Marv. They had this arrangement for Amgen. But Boulder wanted to license this chemistry to Beckman.
And just because of the traditional relationship they'd had with Beckman?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I really don't know. Beckman was a big player in those days, and okay. Now, and I don't remember, this is something you might have to check with someone else or in the records, I do not remember if the notion of using that same valving that we use for the protein sequencer was mentioned in the license from Caltech to Applied Bio for the protein sequencer, if mention was made of a DNA synthesizer or not, mm-hmm. because it was obviously only Roy's hood to get involved in a DNA synthesis.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I don't know. But Arnold Beckman.
There's a big room here, so if you don't have a presentation or anything, I have to move Darwin into here.
All right.
We can move some.
Yeah, we can go to my office.
Oh, sure.
Let's do that.
Chair in
them. Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Sam, you doing okay? Do you need a drink or anything? Okay.
Okay, maybe we'll leave the door open because it will get hot in here. Okay, go ahead, carry on.
So there was an issue with getting the license from getting the DNA license, the license from Boulder, and Arnold Beckman had been a little bit upset, I think, as to why Beckman did not get the protein sequencing license and we did. And I think the reason we did is because we made an argument that we could make those valves much quicker than the others. That's why the thing I wasn't sure of.
Yeah. Okay. So this is this the valve. I'm not sure what it does, but it's something common to both the
valve,
sequencer and the synthesizer.
The valve was used in all four machines that Applied Bio built: the protein sequencer, DNA synthesizer, peptide synthesizer, and DNA sequencer.
So, and this is a key piece.
It's a key piece, and it
it came from the Planck Institute.
I found out later that it came from the Planck Institute. That's one thing that Lee doesn't always advertise where he gets his ideas from. Okay?
Yeah.
And so I had to travel to Berlin. That was before the wall had fallen. I traveled to Berlin and meet with, there was a husband and wife who ran a laboratory in Berlin. I forget their name now. And they had filed a patent on that valve. And I had to get a license for that valve before we commercialized our instrument.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
And that was a big... I was scared for a while that they might exact a huge thing, but I was able to negotiate a reasonable thing. It took several trips to Berlin to do it and all that. But we made... Look, one of the things I learned at Hewlett-Packard is that if you have a particular trick that works well and you can use it in a variety of applications, that's what you should do.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's what. So I built the company around that valve, and I found the machinist who could do it and do it right. I gave him an opportunity to create his company to do it. He's forever grateful. He did a good job. You know, that's how things work in the valley, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So.
So the DNA synthesizer was the.
So we had a problem getting the license for the DNA synthesizer. And at the time we wanted to get the license, Beckman was making noises about trying. It was a time when, and I'm not sure of exactly the details of the fact I'm talking about some hearsay stuff here. There was a big building that Arnold Beckman had promised to Caltech, which is called the Beckman Building now or something. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I heard from whether Lee Hood or one of Lee Hood's people that Arnold had threatened to withhold putting that building unless his company got access to the DNA chemistry, because it was too late to get the protein sequencing that had already been done. Okay. So there was a little bit of an issue. And Marv himself felt that his chemistry was probably worth more than what Applied Bio was willing to pay for it, and he wanted to go and commercialize it somewhere else. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And
he may have been right about that too. I mean, in retrospect, looking back at how huge,
And so few games were played at the time, and my game was, having worked at Hewlett-Packard and knowing that Hewlett-Packard was likely a better company than Beckman, and even so, things took time for products to come out of Hewlett-Packard. So I figured it would take even more time to come out correctly out of Beckman. Mm-hmm. So I said, give us a co-exclusive license. This way Arnold is not going to scream, but I'll be in the market 2 years before him anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Which would happen. This is the way it happened.
So they did start working on it.
We started working on it at
Beckman, did they?
Yeah, they started. They got a license too.
We got
a co-exclusive license.
And so you're keeping an eye on what they're doing. You know who those people are and what they're up to. Or
now you mean?
What? No, then.
No, I wasn't concerned. I knew they'd be 2 or 3 years later than us, and they were. I mean, that's basically what happened.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that the engineers that I had, who had produced a protein sequencer with a much more complicated chemistry in less than a year, would do my DNA synthesizer in a year and a half. So that was
mm-hmm.
okay.
Yeah.
And I knew Beckman would take 3 to 3 years at least, so that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
So we got a co-exclusive on that one.
Yeah.
And so.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in terms of convincing Marv, I think his collaboration with Leroy Hood was important to him, and since Leroy wanted and we gave Marv a nice stock option mm-hmm. in the company. I think the one thing I remember about Marv, I don't know if you want to put that in your thing. You'll get a chance to review everything. You'll do it in a more diplomatic way than I'm saying.
But
I think it's important information, but the trick is how to word it without offending.
Certainly.
The one thing I remember, Marv, is that every time we met, he would always finish the discussion by asking me, is there any way he could get more stock? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Marv, is there any way we can get more stock? Leroy Hood, is there another instrument we develop?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, at the time you completed the DNA synthesizer, is this after the company's gone public? Or prior? It's 83, I think.
83 is the public offering. I think in the... You have all the annual reports, don't you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You should be able to find... I don't remember.
But what I really want to hear is, at the business end, you've got the protein synthesizer on the market.
Protein sequencer.
The sequencer. And that's the first product.
And
that changes the company, yeah? Then you have revenues and...
We went public, we had positive revenue.
Mm-hmm.
At the time we went public, we were profitable.
Mm-hmm. Right. Which is unusual for a biotech company. But
Well, we're an instrument company.
Yeah, that's right, yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you're growing, the company's changing, and you have to... This is the first company you've run by yourself, right?
Yeah.
How was that process, managing all of that?
Well, I think the process of managing it was modulated a lot by two things. One is that the manner in which we're chosen the employee in the company, and by and large, they were chosen based on a number of criteria. Is one, they were not stars in their field or advertise themselves as stars in their field. Okay? That's... Mike Hunkerpiller was an exception to the rule because he had... the amount of value that he brought in was far greater than any negatives I saw in his self-promotional stuff.
He strikes me as kind of a quiet, self-effacing guy. Is that not... maybe just in relation to... in relative terms.
No. Mike is... he's convinced that he knows it better than anybody else. okay? Mm-hmm. Which is not always true.
Yeah. But it's not necessarily always bad to have that conviction.
No, fair enough.
Yeah.
And I figured that as long as in the final analysis the decision is made by me or Andre or by other people around him, that's all right, because he's also an honest individual, so it's not, mm-hmm. He may have a conviction, but if I can sit down with him and reason him and show him the other way, or show him why I want to change it or something, he won't fight it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So he's reasonably balanced. But all I'm saying is, as an exception, is that he is a star in the field. There's no question about it, from the work that he had done with Leroy and all that.
Mm-hmm.
However, the other thing is that he was also a failure in the field, because he wanted to become a prof at Caltech, and he didn't. That's why he came to Applied.
Oh, so I didn't know that. I mean, Mm-hmm. And when he arrived, where was the DNA synthesizers? Did he work on that, or was that after?
No, he was. He came and continued to work on refinements of the protein sequencer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
I see.
The DNA synthesizer was Bilevkovich's job.
I see. Okay. Yeah.
Bilevkovich managed the.
So he was. So Mike was hanging around at Caltech, trying to get onto the faculty.
That's my interpretation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think Mike didn't like being in the shadow of Lee.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because he's a good scientist also.
Mm-hmm.
I won't make a judgment as to whether he's better or good as Lee or something, but that's not the point. But he's a good scientist, and he's a measured individual. And I think that he wanted to have
his own lab. Yeah.
He wanted to have at Caltech what Lloyd Smith got at Wisconsin.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, he and Lloyd were together in the lab.
Mm-hmm.
At Lee Hood, they were postdocs at the same time.
Right.
One became a professor. The other one mm-hmm. came to apply to run a project, and a year or two later, I made him head of research. So.
Yeah. And that process, when how did you ask him?
What?
To come?
To
you had something in mind for him at Applied Bio?
I wanted him to come from the day of opening the company, mm-hmm. from the day of starting.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, first he would tell me his wife didn't want to move to the North Bay. She didn't like it and all that. It was going to be costly, and she didn't like the San Francisco area. I don't know whether it's true or not, but that's the excuse he provided.
Mm-hmm.
I invited him and his wife from company expense to come and spend the weekend. I took him out. I worked very hard at convincing him and her to come to there, because I knew that Applied Biosystems, for the creation of the next generation of products that would have to come out, needed someone like Mike to complement the people we already had. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As CEO, how was the IPO process?
Here I'm going to be getting into a chapter that I've worked on in my book. Nothing to do with the IPO process, but it had to do with... My biggest problem with the IPO process was to keep the CFO out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And... which I did. Mm-hmm. And... but before we get to the IPO process...
Mm-hmm.
I want to get to the 5-point-something million that we raised to start the company.
Yeah.
We started the company, remember, with the $500,000 that I got as advance payments,
mm-hmm.
and so on. And following that, I had to make the rounds of venture capital firms that were, on the one hand, the venture capital firms where the Bilbo's was at the time forming his
U.S. venture.
U.S. Venture Partners. As a matter of fact, Applied Bio, I think, was the second investment by U.S. Venture Partners. Amgen may have been the first, and Applied was the second. And I think the third or fourth was the cheap clothes company, Ross.
Ross, yeah, right.
Okay. I always found it funny to be in company of Ross. But Bill was forming that company. Now, the 50,000 that bought 50% of the company, no, his 50,000 bought him 10% of the company. Mm-hmm. And as were the other 50,000 of the four others. Moshe got 10% that way, and so on. And now, I never knew exactly whether this 50,000 that each put in came out of their own pocket and went to stock in their personal name, or whether it went to their firms, because their firms came later at a higher valuation.
Mm-hmm.
So whether they used that process to, I don't know. So I never looked into it.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, I had to go to their firms, or the firms they were associated with.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, in Pitch Johnson's case, it didn't make any difference because his firm was his money. So,
mm-hmm.
And so I had to make the rounds of the venture capital firms. I had to go see Gene Kleiner. I didn't see Gene Kleiner initially. It was when we were about to close, about a couple of months before we closed that deal, that I got a call from Brooke Byers,
mm-hmm.
who was assistant Gene Kleiner at the time. His name was not yet on the firm. And so I got a call from Brooke Byers, says, I hear you're starting a company and you're raising money. How come Kleiner Perkins was not invited? I said, well, because I don't need them. And I didn't know who they were. And he said, no, you definitely need us. We can open a lot of doors for you, and so on and so forth. I said, who are you? He gave me his name again, and he said, I work with Gene Kleiner. You can tell Moshe Alafi and Bill Bowes the same. I've already heard that they were involved and all that. So I called Bill Bowes and said, do you think it's worth having? We already have the commitment for under 5 million something. Bill said, well, you know, an extra half million is not going to hurt. And besides, they can probably open a few doors for you. I said, well, that's what Brooke Byers promised, that he would make some connections and open some doors.
Mm-hmm.
So I called back and said, yeah. So I went to meet Gene Kleiner. He passed.
Mm-hmm.
I fit the profile that he was looking for, I suppose. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the Rothschild Group. And Rothschild Group in New York at the time was run by Blair.
Jim Blair.
Mm-hmm. And so I went to see Jim Blair. Moshe, Bill, I think, had made the introduction to Jim Blair. I went to New York to see Jim Blair. And he said, well, the decision will be made in London. And you have to go to visit Rothschild in London.
Excuse me, I'll turn this off.
Sorry. So I went to London, and I was ushered in St. Swithin's Lane. I was ushered into an office with the portraits of half dozen Rothschilds that all look alike. And with a old furniture, and green velvet covered table. Trey came in with some tea and cookies, and I kept waiting. Then somebody walked in and said, extremely sorry, Lord Rothschild cannot see you today. However, he suggests that you go and see Dr. Sidney Brenner in Cambridge, because he never makes an investment biology without advice of Sidney Brenner. I had never heard of Sidney Brenner at the time. So I took the next train to Cambridge and went to see Sidney. and explained to him that I was a physicist by training, trying to build a protein sequencer.
Excuse me, sorry. Okay, go ahead.
And that I didn't know anything about it, but I thought that I could automate the various chemical steps that had been explained to me by Leroy Hood and Hunker Piller.
Mm-hmm.
And he nodded his head a few times, and he must have liked what I told him, because I heard from the Rothschild group a few days later that they were going to be co-lead of the investment.
Yeah, and later on, did he tell you what, you know, his evaluation or what he thought of it?
Well, that was the beginning of my relationship with Sidney Brennan, is still ongoing.
So. Yes, yes.
And he thought the gas phase version of the chemistry very ingenious. And he was a little bit reluctant to admit it, but Sidney's an honest person. He always admits what really is. I think his reluctance came from the fact that there's a little bit of a public relation rivalry between him and Sidney Brenner.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, they like one another and all that, but they're always a little sensitive to what the other guy is claiming and mm-hmm. saying and so on. And but then, as a representative of the Rothschild, mm-hmm. Who had made the investment, Jim Blair joined our board. Sidney.
Mm-hmm.
Got in the habit of visiting us every 3 months or so to look at the progress we were making and what we were doing. And then one day he came in to say that, you know, I would probably not going to be able to, that was a few years later, he came in and said, I probably won't be able to come and visit you anymore. It'll be a conflict for me because I have invented a twist on your chemistry that DuPont is going to develop as a DNA sequencer.
Huh.
And he described it to me, and I told him, well, it's a nice twist. I think it's an advance of what, but he said, well, you know, I've been a consultant for DuPont for many years, and I think they can do a nice instance. So I'm no longer cannot be a consultant to you, it would be unfair. I said, fine. I looked at the thing. I told him, but Sidney, it's not going to work. Not the chemistry that you invented, but the way they're going to implement it and the instrument is not going to work. He said, no, it will. They're putting a lot of money in it. But the end result of that story was that a few years later, DuPont gave the list of customers to Applied Bio and gave Applied Bio the chemistry that Sidney had invented that mm-hmm. very much improved the performance of the Applied Bio DNA sequencer.
Ah.
And then Sidney came back to be a consultant to Applied Bio.
Oh, okay. What was the improvement in the chemistry?
Yeah, I can't.
I have to look it up. Okay. Right. Sidney Brenner is a famed molecular biologist.
Yes.
Hanging out with Watson and Crick. And
I'm familiar with him. Yeah.
Actually, tell you. Sidney Brenner, he's a very good friend with François Jacob in France, who's another Nobel Prize winner,
mm-hmm.
and often comes to Paris to visit him, talk to him, been associated with him. And Jacob got the Nobel Prize for some function of RNA, and Jacob has always maintained that much of that work Sidney deserved to be part of it.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, when Sidney got his Nobel Prize 5 or 6 years ago, mm-hmm. 6 or 7 years ago.
Yeah, something like that. I don't know the exact date. Yeah.
He got it for work that he had proposed 30 to 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they there was a time before he got the Nobel Prize where he used to like to brag that he was the only one who had been overlooked twice for it. Anyway, that's
right. So we've talked about the DNA synthesizer, and then
after that came a protein, a peptide synthesizer.
Yeah, and what's the difference between
synthesizer?
Oh, right. Okay.
Peptide synthesizer.
Mm-hmm. And the market for that is who's going to use these peptides?
Drugs.
Yeah.
Drugs that you make, or research on drugs that you make. You make certain synthetic peptides. You know.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And here Lee Hood introduced us to a scientist whose name I forget now. He was from New Zealand, if I remember correctly, who had invented a chemical means of assembling amino acids. And I struck a deal with him because I wanted to complete that quadrilogy of instruments. And we built an instrument that sold for several years until the work switched to doing the same thing by gene splicing and manufacturing proteins another way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, but it was a successful instrument, paid for itself for the years it was produced.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that came the DNA sequencer. But the DNA sequencer, we started working on the DNA sequencer immediately at the same time, almost, as the DNA synthesizer.
Uh-huh.
And it took several years to break it, in large part because we wasted a lot of time trying to reproduce the, in a commercial version, the prototype setup that Leroy had developed his fluorescence work in, that column I mentioned.
Yeah, so initially you had the chemistry for just, you had different chemistry for each base? Each nucleotide?
I don't remember the details. Mm-hmm. I can give you the name of the chemist. I cannot give it to you right now because it escapes my mind. I'll have to look it up and email it to you.
Okay.
He was the biochemist I hired at Applied Bio.
Mm-hmm.
He published the paper that was published together with Lloyd Smith. There were two guys on the paper with Lloyd Smith on the DNA sequencer. One was Lloyd Smith, one was Steve Fung, F-U-N-G, Steve, and the third name escapes me right now.
Okay, well we can find the paper, no problem.
Okay, you can find the paper and look at it, and it will mention the details of the chemistry.
Okay, yeah. But initially the chemistry was, Lee Hood started it, and then you developed the rest of it. You got to start and then develop the rest at Applied Bio.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this
but mostly it was the instrument development was really the one that took a lot of time. We had to develop an instrument capable of looking at four different colors. We had to develop four different dyes for which four different detectors could be used.
Right.
Okay. And so, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And this was, did you have any idea how big this would be? I mean, the implications? I mean, this enabled the Human Genome Project, right? This machine.
Well, it enabled the Human Genome Project, but from the very beginning of anybody who thought about doing the Human Genome Project was in order to discover markers in the Human Genome Project that would be indicative of disease.
Yeah.
Okay. So there was no question that developing a DNA sequencer would enable the development of diagnostic applications. However, I don't think that at the time anybody thought that the cost of sequencing DNA would be as low as it is today.
Yeah,
I don't think anybody would have predicted that in any way. I mean, the cost of DNA sequencing has come down much faster than Moore's law.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So putting this machine together, it takes maybe 3 or 4 years to complete?
Well, we started it in, I think, we probably started thinking about it earlier, but we started it in late 82, 83. Mm-hmm. Late 82, and we finished it and shipped the first prototypes of the first ones in 86. Mm-hmm.
And by this time, Mike Hunkapiller is running research.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he had a big hand in making this machine.
No.
No, not in terms of doing the technical work that went into it. Yeah. But he's managing the process.
Well, he was the R&D manager. I stopped being the R&D manager, I think it was a year and a half after the going public or something like that. Mm-hmm. Look, even as an R&D manager, the reason I kept that title is because I was determined to make sure that there was a particular unity in the family of instruments we were going to build. Mm-hmm. I wanted to make sure that things remained consistent, and I wanted to make sure also that the same process that went into developing and translating into a commercial instrument was followed. Mm-hmm. Now, the one thing that I learned at Hewlett-Packard is that it was very important to make sure that the transition from a research product to a manufacturing instrument is very, very carefully done, and done by the same people who followed from one to the other. Mike didn't know anything about manufacturing, and even when the instrument was finishedly manufactured, it indicated a couple of things about that were unique about Applied Biosystems. I don't know if they have remained after I left. There never was a project manager who managed the whole project. There was someone in charge of the chemistry, someone in charge of the mechanics, and someone in charge of the electronics. Mm. And if needed, someone in charge of the software. And it was their collective responsibility, the four of them, to manage the project. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I overlooked that to make sure that they did not fight with one another, which they never did. Mm-hmm. And I wanted also to make sure that the people who were involved in the development moved with the instrument all the way up to the manufacturing process until such a time when the manufacturing people, which were technicians of a lower order, mm-hmm. in terms of educational accomplishments, became trained on the process. And then there were the service engineers and service biochemists that had to be trained in the process. Some of them came out of the R&D group and moved along to other aspects. Mm-hmm.
What would be the best way to sort of trace the technical development of this, of the product? Would we look at patents?
The DNA sequencer?
Yeah, the DNA sequencer. All of them, but in particular.
I think that if you managed to locate Cheryl Heiner,
right,
Steve Fung, and the third one whose name...
That's okay, we'll find it. But he didn't come from Caltech. He was somebody that you hired up here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Nobody came from Caltech besides Mike Hunkapiller.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Did Lloyd Smith, was he consulting on...
He consulted for a while, yeah.
Yeah, did he? And which projects in particular?
On the DNA sequencer.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah. And Lee Hood's watching the whole thing, too.
No.
He was not involved.
I'm sure that he didn't.
Uh-huh.
Okay, nothing that have anything against Lee.
Sure.
Just that what I did, one of the reasons Applied did as well as it did in the short time, mm-hmm. to have produced four major instruments that were all successful, all money making, in 6 short years,
yeah.
it's very unusual. Okay, and the reason it happened is because I would not allow any consultants or board members to interact with anybody in the company.
Okay. Is that, that's a Hewlett-Packard lesson? Or
I don't want to blame everything on Hewlett-Packard. But no, it's just that, you know,
you wanted to let them do their thing. Yes.
I honestly don't know the right answer to give you.
Okay.
I think you may hear differently from them, but I think I had a personal relationship with every one of my employees, because nobody was hired without my interviewing him or her. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so everybody who was hired had to be hired on a unanimous vote of all the people who had been selected to interview. So if anybody doubted, we didn't hire. Mm-hmm. We just wanted to make sure that people could work together mm-hmm. and liked one another. Mm-hmm. Now, if we did any discrimination that applied by our systems, we did discrimination against people that anybody there didn't like. It didn't matter who anybody was. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, as a result of this, I think I maybe in fooling myself into believing it, but I think that I established a personal relationship with the employees, and I felt that that personal relationship was such that if there is any problem, they would come to me and let me know about it. They will never be scared of letting me know of any problem, whether it is their problem or a problem they're having with anybody else. Mm-hmm. And that if a board member came walking around and started finding out about problems or finding out about things, they wouldn't know what to say. Mm-hmm. Okay. So there was no point in doing that. Mm-hmm. And as long as from quarter to quarter sales went up and up and up, the board members were happy not to interfere.
Mm-hmm. And that did in fact, I mean, you're introducing these instruments. So
look at the the 6 year of Applied Biosystems annual report, and just
right.
The hiring, mm-hmm. revenue, and earnings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you know, enormously successful. But as you said, it took a personal toll on you. You were feeling this along the way.
Well, you know, I'm not complaining because I enjoy it. It's the period of my life that I enjoyed the most. Okay, so. Mm-hmm. But it did take a toll.
Right. And so you felt you had to resign in 1987.
Yeah. And I had to resign, and I knew that by resigning it was going to create a problem, and I tried to manage that resignation as best as I could, but I didn't do it a very good job of it.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with.
No, I mean.
Yeah, what happened?
Well, the stock dropped, of course.
Yeah.
And it recovered afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And is this something that you had thought about for, you know, maybe a year? No, it was just that a crisis occurred. And then
look, there came a time when you know, I was traveling in Europe, making a round. The typical roadshow that every 6 months or so one mm-hmm. does to reassure investors in various places and all that, I had to cut short two or three meetings. I fell ill on one, and I decided, well, I can't continue. I'm going to have to let somebody else do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
for right. the good of the company.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. And it is as time went on over the years. Did you feel, I mean, on the one hand, you're watching the company, what's going on inside, developing these machines, you know, you've got the team, and then managing everything else, you know, taking care of investors, taking care of Wall Street, and did that become, you know, a much bigger job as time went on compared to just running?
Well, the only thing I remember of my interactions with Wall Street is the following. Mm-hmm. On the road shows, it was meeting after meeting in rooms, in hotels, big rooms usually, where a bunch of velour-covered chairs are laid out in the room, you know, mm-hmm. you know that stuff. And a group of people come and sit down, and you give your talk, and some of them take notes, some of them don't. They ask you a few ridiculous questions after the meeting. And the only thing I remember of these meetings is when they stand up and they turn around, all I see is the shiny bottoms of their pants or skirts, because they have rubbed them all week and all month on velour chairs like the ones that were with me without producing anything.
But it's still an important part of the job. You have to show up and do that. Yeah. Well, you had a very successful company. There must have been lots of people looking at it. You know, we'd like to take you over.
Right? Well, they did eventually.
Yeah, eventually.
Yeah.
But that was after you were gone.
Yeah.
Were people knocking on the door? Well.
No.
No.
No. Look, from the very beginning, I'd go in a meeting like these meetings where mm-hmm. people would show me their shiny bottoms. And they asked me questions about competition. Well, who's your competition? I answered, well, what competition? We dominated every field we entered.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And anybody called because they wanted to have an association, I'm fine. What price do you want to sell me your company? Okay. I was very arrogant to the outside world.
Yeah.
Okay. All the arrogance I could not exercise on my employees.
mm-hmm. You really did have a sense that you had the best, that you were way ahead of everybody.
Well,
yeah, no, it's
it was.
That, yes, obviously it was, yeah.
It was. Mm-hmm. And, well, I mean, after the three-year hiatus where I had to take care of some cardiac problems, I went back as a consultant to ABI. And mm-hmm. It was just about the time when Perkin Elmer had made their offer.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's what got Links started.
Yeah. Well, this would probably be a good juncture to...
Yeah, sure.
...to stop, but I would like to talk to you another time about Links and all the other things that you've been involved in the next time you're around. How often do you get over this way?
Well, I'm going to be in California until early March.
Okay, well, maybe between now and then.
And then after that, I probably won't be returning until May or June.
Yeah. Well, that's not that far off. I mean, so,
yeah.
And your main company now is Population Genetics?
No, I've got three companies.
Yes.
It's Population Genetics, which I'm very busy right now recruiting a CEO for it. The former CEO was someone whom I had hired at Hewlett Packard the first year I got to be head of a department there. Mm-hmm. And... who had followed me to Applied Biosystems. And after Applied Biosystems, he got bored with Applied Biosystems some 10 years ago, a little longer, maybe 12, 13 years ago. Mm-hmm. Went back to Hewlett-Packard just before it split into Agilent and Hewlett-Packard. So he went back to the same section of Hewlett-Packard where we had worked, mm-hmm. which had grown quite a bit, and then was split into Agilent. And when it was split into Agilent, he no longer liked being there. Mm. And so I succeeded in recruiting him to run Population Genetics.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
He said yes, but only for 3 years, because he doesn't want to live in England for longer than that.
Mm.
So we finished that a year ago. Now in the process of replacing him.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And that company grew from ideas that Sydney and I had explored at Links, that...
Mm-hmm.
and that the investors in Links and Solexa were not interested in pursuing, so we decided to pursue it.
Mm-hmm.
History repeats itself in funny ways. And so Population Genetics is now showing people how they can interrogate 1,000 genomes in one test tube for a particular disease.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you don't have to sequence 1,000 genomes. You can one at a time. You can look at all of them in one putt.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're doing.
Yeah. No, there's a lot there that I would like to talk about that whole period from the early 90s. And
I can show you the latest company
okay.
created. I'll just show you the product.
And this is in Paris?
No, this one is in Geneva.
Oh. Are you in Paris? Do you live in Paris?
I have an apartment in Paris, yeah. Yeah. Can you hear this? It's starting?
Yeah, there it is. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's Andrew.
It just uses commercial pipettes. You don't have to buy a full robot and all that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
It uses commercial pipettes and does the hand motions that you want it to do.
Yeah. You can program it to do whatever. You
program it on one of these.
Yeah. Great. Mm-hmm. So you're selling them? Are they on the market?
Is
it a prototype?
Prototype. Mm-hmm. We started this company 8 months ago.
Uh-huh.
And we have 3.5 that are going to 3 companies next month.
Mm-hmm. Great.
And shipping within a year.
Uh-huh. Still have the same model. Right? For getting things out and
getting good people, hiring good scientists.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's interesting, yeah.
Yeah. The reason for Andrew is because that was the name of the first name of a robot in an Isaac Asimov book, and that's where the name Android comes from.
Ah, okay, I didn't know that.
I was going to ask how.
Yeah. Very good.
And the third company is a biotechnology company in Strasbourg, France, which is a GPCR company, which has a technology for screening very rapidly the pharmaceutical company's library of compounds against GPCRs.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So everything is focused on taking advantage of
techniques.
Yes.
Yeah.
Great.
All right.
Thank you, Sam.
Well, you're welcome.
Listen, before you go, we have a release form here, and I'll give you a copy of this. You can.
I don't need a copy.
This just says that we're going to make a transcript of the interview, and we'll send you the transcript.